we transformed into emotional wrecks. Faced with tenderness, they became tenderized, and it made them cry. Corey blew his nose harshly, as if in an attempt to gain control. The goose honk was anything but gentle. "I suspect you're not used to talking about yourself," she said.
"No, I'm not. It's stopped being a thing for me."
"Why is that?" He shrugged.
"Bad breakup. But it was a long time ago."
She closed her eyes and opened them. Instantly, he was reminded of Slowey, who often did that. Was Slowey thinking hard in those moments, or was he adrift in reptile space-time? "I'm not sure time is always a determinant to acceptance," Lisa said. "You still think about this person?"
"Yes, Greer."
"Greer was someone you talked to about yourself, which means about your feelings, and now you've lost that."
"Yeah, that and basically everything else."
The word lost made him think of Soulfinder, but he would not find Albie ever. He had lost Greer in a more ordinary way, a breakup. People rarely spoke of a breakup as tragic. Instead, breakups were part of life. But when you and the other person broke up, you could look for them everywhere. And maybe you would physically find them. But even if they were the same person, they were not for you. They were not yours. The evaporation of love was like a kind of death. Lisa Henry obviously understood this. She looked at him with an expression that was so compassionate, it was as though she thought he had been pierced with 1,000 arrows. Time was up. She stood, and then he stood, and they both nodded to each other, and then she opened the door. This one session was enough for him, he realized. Seeing her had been useful, but it was enough. Corey went outside, where the afternoon was fading, but seemed as if it had been gently buffed while he was indoors. Boy meets world, he thought, and he headed for his car.
Chapter 14. Daytime, when you didn't have a job, wasn't just something to rush through, but to spend time in. Greer, unemployed, found patches of sun and little swirls of wind and a coffee shop in Brooklyn with a good mix of chatter and quiet. She sat in all these places and read books the way she used to when she was a girl, back when there was nothing else she had to do, nowhere else she had to be, and no one looking out for her. She read with abandon, it would probably be called, though when you read a book, you didn't abandon anything. Instead, you marshaled it all. After she'd left Losi and left Faith in such a dramatic way, books were still there. She read Jane Austen, and she read Jane Eyre, the two Janes, which Z had once confused. She read a contemporary French novel in which all the characters were desperate, and there were no quotation marks, only little dashes, which made Greer feel kind of crazy, but also kind of French. She sat in the coffee shop, taking her time, and she thought about how she'd always wondered who those people were who sat in coffee shops in the middle of the day, and now she knew. Some of them were like her, the jobless, the lost. She sat there feeling very much unlike herself. She had enough money to last a couple of months, so she didn't need to rush into another job. Losi was over, and more than that, so was Faith Frank. Z was only half over. They'd had a series of email exchanges recently, in which Greer had tried to prostrate herself again, at first seriously, then wittily, and Z had written back a few short, amused notes, so it seemed that a thaw was starting. One afternoon when she was home, drowsing on her couch, Corey called.
"Greer?" he said. "It's Corey Pinto."
As opposed to Corey who?
"You might know another one," he said. "It's possible. So do you remember you told me I could stay with you if I ever came to New York?"
"Sure."
"Feel free to take it back. But I'm coming down to go see a play, Immersive Theater. Our investor wants me to go, and he bought me a ticket. I thought I could stay over for 2 nights if it's convenient."
Corey drove down from Macapie and showed up Thursday night with a backpack. They hugged awkwardly in her doorway. Right away, she ordered takeout from the Thai place, knowing that food would be a distraction from the strangeness. They sat and ate at the small table in Greer's living room. In the low light, with the containers of food open all around them, he told her more about the slow, painstaking creation of the video game, his partnership with his friend from Valley Tech, the environmental artists who had been hired, and the investor who was paying for all of this.
"There's no guarantee it will become anything," Corey said. "It's not mainstream at all, and the market is flooded. But I don't know. Is it obnoxious to say I'm a little hopeful?"
"No, I think it's great," she said.
"And as for my mom, I didn't know there could be improvement after such a long time. But there is. I don't think she needs me in the same way."
"That's so great. And what does that mean for you?"
"That's exactly what I asked myself," Corey said. "I'll be okay, Greer. You don't have to worry."
"I'm not worried," she said. But she remembered that she had done nothing but worry about him after Albie died. She had worried so hard that he would lose himself and that she would lose him. But it wasn't that he had lost himself. He was always going to be the person who stayed and helped. She hadn't seen that. "I'm sorry about how I was," she said, "with you."
"Well, I am too. How I was, I mean."
He smiled.
"If there was ever a more generic and vague conversation, I've never heard it."
"It's weird," she said, "the way sometimes you're in your life, but other times you're looking back at it like a spectator. It kind of goes back and forth, back and forth."
"And then you die."
She laughed a little. "Yes, and then you die."
"Hey, I watched your speech," he suddenly said.
"You did?" She was shocked, tense. The speech was out there, findable.
"You were good," he said. "It's cool to think of you getting up there in front of everyone."
"Me with my outside voice, not my inside one," she said quickly. Then she added, "Well, that's over anyway, the whole loci thing." What she felt talking about loci, above and beyond her anxiety and anger, was a strange and strangled kind of grief. It couldn't be compared with Corey's grief, which would have blown it away, but it still qualified. Her grief wasn't for the job. A job could be recovered from. Maybe she would give other speeches someday, wherever she ended up working, even little speeches in a conference room to 12 people. And there would probably be other jobs with a do-good tang to them, other offices with desks for Greer to sit at, and a minestrone or mushu smell around the noon hour, and co-workers who had good days and snappish ones, people with coffee on the breath and personal habits that you would learn, as though you were lovers and not just people who worked in the same place. The grief being brought up now, as it often was when she thought about having left her job, was about Faith. Faith, who was barely even a fully realized person to Greer. She felt herself well up, and she thought, "Here I go." "The thing about Faith, Frank," she said to Corey, "the thing I keep thinking about, she wasn't my friend exactly. She was definitely my employer, but that's not the whole description. What was she? I loved what she stood for. I wanted to stand for those things too. And in the end, everything fell apart, and she turned on me. Maybe she was right to behave that way. Maybe even though she's Faith Frank, she's allowed to have a really bad moment, too, where she says something not so great to someone else. I just didn't like being the person she said it to. But I'm not one to talk. I did something really bad to Z." Corey looked at her, surprised. "I did," she went on. "I know you didn't expect that. It's like people can't help doing things to people. I've been working that one through with Z slowly. There's movement there, but Faith. When I really think about Faith, I get this terrible sensation in my chest, and I feel like I'll never recover."
"You will," said Corey. "And I say that with authority."
He yawned right then, and embarrassed, immediately tried to cover it up. You're tired, she said.
No, it's fine. We can keep talking.
Greer went to the closet and pulled out a towel for him. Here you go, she said. I'll make up the couch for you. He took his little kit into the bathroom while she placed sheets on the mattress of the small, fold-out sofa. This was an era in which sofa beds were frequently opened and unfolded. At this age, people were still floating, not entirely landed, still needing places to stay the night sometimes. They were doing what they could, crashing in other places, living extemporaneously. Soon enough, the pace would pick up. The solid matter of life would kick in. Soon enough, sofa beds would stay folded. Corey came out of the bathroom as Greer was spreading the quilt over the sheets. He wore a different t-shirt, one for bed, and he smelled of some kind of unfamiliar skin lotion or soap. He'd changed his routine, she thought, with some unhappiness, as if she should have been alerted to the change. But of course it had been a long time now since they had seen the various products each other used. The private and the mundane, which together became intimacy. Corey went to the opened sofa and lay down on it, his too tall body needing to be angled in order to fit. She heard the exhausted protest of the springs, and she shut off the light and went to lie down in her own bed across the room. With the blinds turned, it was sealed in dark in the apartment, and neither of them had any more thoughts about their missions. Instead, they were intensely self-conscious, and each sound that came from somewhere in the room was too much, could make them jump. Neither of them wanted to scare the other or do the wrong thing, so they lay quietly and respectfully, as if it were nighttime and they were patients in the same hospital ward. "You okay over there?" she asked.
"I'm fine," said Corey. "Thanks for having me, Space Cadetsky."
It was so dark that at first she couldn't see him across the room, but could just hear him repositioning his limbs and then yawning again, the hinge of his jaw opening, being held open involuntarily, then closing. He was somewhere over there. That was what she knew. For a little while, she didn't see him at all. But then her eyes adjusted, and she did. Chapter 15. It was one of those parties where you could never find your coat, which maybe wasn't the worst thing, because no one wanted to leave and go out into the world, which had changed so stunningly. Even now, years in, no one could get used to it. And conversation at parties still centered around the ways that no one had seen it coming. They just could not believe what had happened to the country. The big terribleness, said a tall, spindly, and intense woman, director of online marketing at the publishing house, throwing this party. She was leaning against a wall in the hallway, beneath a series of Diane Arbus photos, holding court. "The thing that really gets me," she said, "is that the worst kind of man, the kind you would never allow yourself to be alone with because you would know he was a danger to you, was left alone with all of us." They laughed darkly, this cluster of women and a couple of men. They drank their drinks, and then they were briefly quiet. Indignity after indignity had taken place, constant hammer strikes against everything they cared about, and they had been marching and organizing and raging. But as a defense, they also frequently went into a self-soothing mode, which by now they'd been doing for years. Drinking had become a part of the self-soothing. Celebrating had become essential, too, and occasionally even warranted. It seemed once again that hopelessness had clarified how valuable the fight had always been. "I assumed there would always be a little progress and then a little slipping, you know? And then a little more progress. But instead, the whole idea of progress was taken away, and who knew that could happen, right?" said this vociferous woman. Tonight they were celebrating the fact that Greer Kadetsky's book, Outside Voices, had just spent one full year on the bestseller list. One full year that seemed to put a thumb in the eye of the big terribleness. The book, certainly not the first of its kind, was a lively and positive-leaning manifesto encouraging women not to be afraid to speak up, but the title also played on ideas of women as outsiders. Greer, age 31 now, had been giving talks around the country on her Outside Voices tour. She visited women's prisons and corporations and colleges and libraries, and she went to public schools where little girls crammed into gyms, and she told them, "Use your outside voices!" They looked nervously toward their teachers, who stood against the walls. "It's okay," the teachers mouthed, and the little girls screamed and shouted, tentatively at first, then with full throat. Outside Voices was frequently criticized, of course. It did not speak for all women, Greer was told. Many women, most women, were so much farther outside of privilege and access than Greer Kadetsky was now. Still, she heard from women and girls from around the country who wrote candid, tender, excited notes to Greer on her website and on the Outside Voices message board, telling her what the book had meant to them. There was talk of an Outside Voices foundation, but nothing concrete. The book had encouraged women to stay strong and loud, and certainly staying strong and loud was urgent. A few years earlier, back at the start of the big terribleness, before she was living with Corey and before Amelia was born, having been freed from loci, Greer had gone to the Women's March in D.C. She'd marched with a group of 500,000 and had felt vigorous, chapped-cheeked, elated. Endorphins were sprung into the bloodstream like balloons into the open sky. The high had lasted the whole 4.5 hours home on a boiling hot coach bus, and for weeks to come, part endorphin rush, part despair. She had been seeing Corey every weekend, either in Brooklyn or up in Macapie, where he still lived as he helped his mother sell the house and resettle. And during that time, Greer worked at a coffee bar, inhaling steam and foam and cinnamon. "I have cinnamon lung," she'd said to Z. And all the while at night, in her free time, she worked on her book. But there were moments now when Greer, falling into a funk of exhaustion or boredom at the prospect of repeating the mantras of her book over and over, wondered whether her book, despite its success, was a little ridiculous. After all, you could use your outside voice and scream your head off, but sometimes it didn't seem as if the screaming was being heard. Tonight, on this wet, slick, and cold night, the publisher, Karen Nordquist, was throwing this party in her showplace of a home, which had a living room with double-height ceilings and a wall of books with a ladder. At some point earlier, Karen had climbed the ladder to give a toast to Greer. Everyone looked nervously up at her as she headed for the top, still holding her martini, but she was fearless. And when she stood up there looking down at the room, she said a little drunkenly, "Wow, I can see the parts in everyone's hair. Very neat." There was laughter. "I can see how much you all care about personal grooming. But more to the point, I can see how much you all care about this amazing book, this phenomenon, Outside Voices. And so do I. Greer, we love you." From down below, Greer said fatuously, "And I love all of you, too." But then she looked around and felt overcome. It wasn't by love, though of course she did love several people in this room. Corey was here, holding Amelia, and there were good friends all around. But this was something else. She was struck by the way everyone was looking toward her with expectation. People wanted one another to do something. They wanted someone to say the thing that they could then take into themselves and transform into something else. A word might land in a certain way, or maybe not even a word, maybe a gesture, or a moment of listening. This platform, Greer's book that tried hard and was encouraging and bracing, was not, she knew, original or brilliant. This platform was definitely imperfect. And Greer wasn't a firebrand. She could never be that. "I'm going to keep this brief," she said, and she saw some people in the room look relieved. No one ever wanted a writer to go on and on at her own book party. "We're here tonight in this strange time, this long, strange time. Every new thing that shocks us is just that, a shock, but not really a surprise. The success of this book in the middle of this time," Greer said, "has been confusing, but also welcome, though of course my poor eardrums are suffering.
This morning I did a school visit with a group of third graders, and those girls have pipes. I'm still in pain. There was laughter. I've never been loud, said Greer. You know that by now.
Oh, you know everything about me by now.
Then she said, I'm going to read just a tiny amount from the book, an amuse-bouche. She picked up the book with its bright cover with the now recognizable image of the open mouth and read for exactly 1 minute and 40 seconds, and then she was finished. They all clapped, then they returned to their worried conversations and their drinking. Greer's face was hot, lit, as it always was from public speaking, even now. Corey came over, Amelia wrapped around his neck, though her eyes looked a little wild. At 15 months of age, she should not have been awake this late, but why not? Her mother had been on the bestseller list for 1 full year. Amelia had stomped around in circles all night, nearly deranged. Earlier, she'd gotten 2 steps up the ladder before her babysitter snatched her by the collar and hauled her in. Now that babysitter, Kay Chung, who was 16 and a high school student who lived with her family in Sheepshead Bay, stood on Corey's other side with her hand on Amelia's head. Kay was small and fireplug fierce, in a bulky Nordic sweater and a little skirt. Greer had hired her on the recommendation of a friend, but Kay turned out to be not only wonderful with the baby, but also wonderful more generally. Kay was, as she described herself without irony or amusement, radical in most of her views, but she warned that that didn't mean they conformed to any one orthodoxy.
So what are you saying exactly? Greer had asked her late on a Saturday night. She and Corey had just returned from a dinner party. They were standing in the front hallway of the brownstone where they now lived, waiting for a car service to come take the babysitter home.
I'm a skeptical person, I guess, said Kay. Pressed, she tried to describe what she meant.
I want you to know I think you're great, Greer. I totally do. My friends and I have all read your book, and they're impressed that I sit for you, she said benevolently. We should all definitely assert ourselves more in the world. That's totally true. But I look at everything that women did and said in recent history, and somehow we still got to a caveman moment, and our responses to it just aren't enough. Because the structures are still in place, yes?
She wasn't asking Greer a question, but just wanted to make a point. Kay was always organizing at her school, getting involved in assemblies and mini-marches, and what she called Twitter fires, in which she took a scorched-earth tone and never apologized. She and her friends didn't care about figureheads, she said dismissively, leaders of a cause, like in the past. These figures weren't necessary, and they weren't even real.
We don't need to put people on a pedestal, she said. Everyone can lead. Everyone can jump in.
She offered these opinions as if they were entirely new. The pleasure and excitement in her voice were stirring. Greer could have said to her, Yes, I know all about this. Faith said that women said the same thing back in the 70s, but that wouldn't have been kind. There shouldn't be a hierarchy, Kay explained, because that always led to someone being kept down. And there had been enough of that throughout history, and no one needed it anymore. And it assumed that the white, cisgender, binary view of everything was the correct one, the only one, when in fact it wasn't. We're done with that for good, she said. And anyway, Kay went on, in a chatty voice of amazing confidence, it wasn't so much about people as it was about ideas. Greer didn't know what to say in response to the babysitter's soliloquy, except to repeat some of what she had already said in the book, taking a tone of encouragement and rage. Encouragement, she'd called it. Since Kay had been babysitting for Amelia on weekends, Greer had given her every item related to outside voices, the hardcover, the workbook, the desk calendar, and, Corey said, the snack food. Also, Kay often said, If you have anything for me to read... And Greer and Corey gave her books, lots of them, novels and collections of essays, and even some of their old college texts, heavily underlined, plus the book that Greer had borrowed from Professor Malik and forgotten to return. Greer had never made sense of that book, but Kay had said it was very interesting and even really funny to read those outdated ways of thinking.
Our babysitter is smarter than we are, Greer liked to say to people. Much. I'm telling you, she's going to go far. But the problem was that the babysitter could not be babied, could not be swaddled and comforted by outside voices. The small triumph of having a well-meaning feminist rallying cry on the bestseller list did not seem to help this girl, who knew she had a real future, but was afraid that everything would be repeatedly smashed to pieces. Now it was time to leave the publisher's party in Greer's honor, though the party would continue on without her. The older people left, and the younger ones stayed. Greer and Corey offered Kay a ride home, but she said, no thanks, did they mind if she stayed a little longer? The babysitter had gotten to know a couple of the interns. She quickly kissed the top of Amelia's head, said, bye, bunny girl, then returned to the pack of interns who pulled her in. I'm so sick of the expression outside voices, Greer said to Corey in the car heading home.
You're the one who unleashed it on the world.
She leaned against him, in close quarters, because the car seat took up a lot of space. Amelia had already closed her eyes, her sweaty head craned at a bad angle. The car bumped along the quiet streets and headed over the bridge. Almost immediately when they crossed into Brooklyn, there was construction. There was always construction. Their brownstone was in Carroll Gardens. They had lived there since the book sale, which was followed immediately by international sales. Corey and Greer had money suddenly, and it shocked them both and made them both uncomfortable. They had been about to renovate the brownstone when Corey had the idea that they should leave it alone. It was already livable enough. And maybe what they should do with their money instead was give a large monthly stipend to Corey's mother and Greer's parents, who could really use it. And once they did that, it was easy and natural to give away more of their money to people they weren't related to. Neither of them knew how long the money would last. It wouldn't self-replenish forever. Greer had had one bestseller. She wasn't the manager of a hedge fund. And maybe there would never be another bestseller. But at least they had done what they could. Soulfinder, when it was finally released, had not become a financial success, though it still occupied a small, respected place in the world of indie video games, more of a sleeper than anything else. The people who had played it were passionate about it. Corey's next game was being planned now, and the same investor had already committed. Corey had thought about going into microfinance all these years after he was supposed to, but the process had changed, and he wasn't up to speed on any of that, and money was always tricky, and he worried that he might screw it up. He hadn't professionally landed, and who knew if he would, but it wasn't an emergency that he hadn't. Corey was working and engaged by work, and he also did a lot around the house, cooking homemade fish fingers for Amelia and vegetarian dishes for Greer, and being in charge of the master schedule. He had it in his mind that he would teach Amelia Portuguese. He had even bought her a DVD of Portuguese children's songs and rhymes, and while the DVD made him think of his mother up in Fall River now and doing very well, it also made him think of his father in Lisbon. Or maybe he had been thinking of his father to begin with, and that was why he had bought the DVD online. Corey had said that he wanted to go to Portugal at some point to see his father, despite what he had done. To see him and then take the family sightseeing, though the trip would wait until Amelia was old enough to get something out of it. At home after the party, they dropped Amelia into her crib, and she didn't stir. There would be no need tonight for stories or water or the motorized light fixture that threw dancing shapes on the ceiling or more stories or more water. Greer saw on her phone that Z had texted from Chicago. I sent you a link, Z wrote. Call me. I want to experience your reaction in real time. So Greer sat in the den and called Z on the phone. The two of them sat before their separate laptops, and Greer clicked on the link that led to a video taken on a shaky cell phone. The setting was vaguely tropical. First, a balding, thickish man opened the door of a garden apartment. As soon as the door opened, a bucket of wet garbage was flung in his face, and the camera swerved hard to show the garbage thrower, a young woman who began to scream. You piece of garbage! You deserve a lot worse than this! She shouted, and the man, covered in garbage in the doorway of his own home, seemed shocked at first, and said, Whoa, what the fuck? But then within seconds he was laughing and exuberant. That's right, he said to her, peeling garbage from the side of his face. Keep throwing it at me. This is assault. Keep it coming. Greer paused the video, froze it in place. Wait, why am I watching this? She asked. Put it on full screen, said Z. So Greer made the image fill the screen of her laptop, and then she came close to it so that her face was nearly pressed against the paused face. She studied the blandness, the lazy smile, the wide-spaced eyes, all of it somehow familiar, but still only mildly. When you thought about it, everything seemed familiar. Every story had its antecedents, and every person. The laughing, garbage-covered man and the woman in her fury, captured together on a residential street someplace where the weather was warm. They were familiar at first only in their familiarity, for you already knew this kind of story, the furious woman and the shrugging, indifferent man. Such stories were ancient. Greer had heard them told at loci and on the road with outside voices, but she also knew of them from well before that. From reading Greek plays, from growing up as a girl. A critical piece of information was returning from a great and exhausting distance. Greer let it come toward her. She patiently waited for its arrival, observing the frozen face. Then she remembered. Tinsler? She said, her voice made thin with awe. Yes. Darren Tinsler? No! Where did you find this? What is it? Someone sent it to Chloe Shanahan, and she sent it to me, said Z. Darren Tinsler runs a revenge porn website called BitchYouDeserveThis.com. He publishes footage and photos of women with a link to their Facebook profiles, and he makes them pay a huge fee to take them down. The fees go to some law firm in Chicago that doesn't really exist. And this woman tried to sue, but she couldn't because his identity was hidden. And anyway, the laws still suck. So she tracked him down, and she went to his door and threw garbage at him while her friend filmed the whole thing. The plan was that they would post it online, thinking that they would shame him, ruin him. But get this. Darren Tinsler retweeted it. He couldn't be shamed or ruined. He just thought it was hilarious. They were both stoppered into silence, considering all this. Greer and Z had worn Darren Tinsler's face on their T-shirts 13 years earlier, had stared at him and his far-apart eyes. He looked similar now, except the face was wider, and the hair was mostly gone, and so was the baseball cap. Their T-shirt campaign had done nothing. And in the ladies' room that night at college, Faith had warned them that if they hounded Darren Tinsler, sympathy will redound to him. But maybe she hadn't been right. Maybe if they'd stayed with it, Greer thought, he would have eventually been asked to leave school, and he might have a record that would have chased him for years. Maybe he would have been monitored and watched instead of going unchecked over time, doing whatever he liked. It's like we kept trying to use the same rules, Greer said. And these people kept saying to us, don't you get it? I will not live by your rules. She took a breath. They always get to set the terms. I mean, they just come in and set them. They don't ask, they just do it. It's still true. I don't want to keep repeating this forever. I don't want to keep having to live in the buildings they make and in the circles they draw. I know I'm being overly descriptive, but you get my point. You could call your next book The Circles They Draw. I don't mean any of this in a bullshit way. I don't mean it to just be words or clever. I don't know if we'll ever figure out the Outside Voices Foundation, or even what it will be. It definitely can't just be feeling good about ourselves, even in adversity. I don't know. Foundations. Is that the answer? Look at loci. No, it couldn't be like loci, said Greer. That whole money thing, the climate is different now. and you could come help me figure it out.
Yeah, sure. I'll solve all the problems.
You have that grassroots experience from Chicago, Greer said. You're so good at all that. Noelle could find a school here, couldn't she? I know this sounds a little bit like, let's put on a show. I don't want it to be like that. I'm just saying, if this ever turns into something, you could be part of it. And I owe you a job, she said lightly.
No, you don't, Z said. You really, really don't.
She paused. And anyway, Greer, I love my work. I know you do. They were both quiet, thinking about Darren Tinsler. A man who degraded and threatened women made you want to do everything possible. Howl and scream, march, give a speech, call Congress around the clock, fall in love with someone decent, show a young woman that all is not lost, despite the evidence. Change the way it feels to be a woman walking down a street at night anywhere in the world, or a girl coming out of a quick stop in Macapee, Massachusetts in daylight holding an ice cream. She wouldn't have to worry about her breasts, whether they would ever grow or grow big enough. She wouldn't have to think anything physical or sexual about herself at all, unless she wanted to. She could dress the way she liked. She could feel capable and safe and free, which is what Faith Frank had always wanted for women. Faith appeared again at moments like this, stamped all of a sudden into a conversation. Walking in the city, Greer would have occasional sightings of an elegant older woman, perhaps flanked by other women, and she would hurry to catch up with her. But then the woman would turn to the side, revealing herself. And not only was it not Faith, it was laughably not Faith. The woman was 30, or the woman was black, or once, the woman was a man. Or most often, the woman was someone who vaguely resembled Faith and who could have been her stunt double, lovely and accomplished-looking. During the women's march, everyone buoyed by the sense of being right. Greer was certain that Faith was there somewhere, she wasn't one of the speakers, and that maybe she would see her. Though their relationship had ended in the worst way, the ice would be broken then and there, and everything that had happened between them would no longer matter. Sometimes you had to let go of your convictions, or at least loosen them far more than you ever thought you would. She would call out, Faith! And in the middle of the crowd of roaring women, Faith would swivel her head and see her. Their long period of being apart would end. She would be returned to Greer like a lost person in Soul Finder. Although, as Z once pointed out, in Soul Finder, you had to go looking for the person you had lost. Faith, now, was closer to 80 than 70. She still worked at the foundation, though 3 years earlier, Emmett Schrader had died of a massive heart attack. His death was itself a significant story, covered widely in the news section of the newspaper and extending into the business section, with profiles and encomiums. But there were also rumors online about the cause of death. He died in bed with a young woman, it was said, having taken a drug for erectile dysfunction. It wasn't that he had been told not to take the drug. He had apparently been told not to have sex, not anymore, or at least not the kind of sex that Emmett seemingly liked, which was active, athletic, whole-bodied, heart-quaking. The foundation was to continue, he'd instructed in his will, though he hadn't paid attention to the details enough to specify at what level, and the people upstairs had decided to reduce Losi's operating budget bit by bit until the foundation essentially became a low-level and modest speakers forum. It occupied a place in the world similar to the one that Bloomer had occupied at the end of its long life. But still it carried on, and still Faith Frank stayed in charge, with a vastly scaled-down staff and a much smaller office on a lower floor of the Strode building. Nothing had ever come out publicly about the mentor program. Ben, who was still at Losi, told Greer that Faith often stayed late at work, and because her new office was so much smaller, she'd had to have a few inches shaved off the top and bottom of her suffrage door desk so that it could still fit. Greer imagined Faith sitting there grimly watching as someone came in with a saw and cut down the door.
Loci no longer held summits, but small gatherings of 25 or 30 people or so, the same size as the lunchtime speeches that they used to give as teasers leading up to the summits. Faith wrote very occasional op-eds for the New York Times and the Washington Post, but had ceased most public speaking. Greer saw pictures of Faith once in a while. More to the point, she sought them out online. It was Faith, despite the deeper lines in the face like a fisherwoman in a woodcut. Faith, with the smile and the intelligence, and always the trademark sexy boots. But Faith in a tighter space, with a lower budget, in wild, uncertain times. Faith still working. Misogyny had stormed the world in an all-out, undisguised raid. The Senate seat of Anne McCauley, who had retired and whose late-life hobby was canning plums, had been filled by her daughter, Lucy McCauley Gevins, whose views of reproductive rights were even more extreme than her mother's, and who had been given much more support and money. Loci was small. Senator Lucy McCauley Gevins was getting bigger. Femme Fatale had lost its popularity over the past couple of years, but there were other sites to replace it, newer, fresher ones, providing sharp commentary, humor, and a receptacle for rage. Rag Times, that sweet little play, was occasionally still performed in community theaters and high schools around the country, and Outside Voices showed no sign of falling off the bestseller list. Also, Opus's old hit, The Strong Ones, was now the song on a famous television commercial, accompanied by the image of a pair of female hands pulling at a sheet of paper towel, which did not rip or disintegrate. Some people defended Opus's decision, said it was good to commodify art, because at least then you could get your message into the shared waters of the culture. Everyone knew that you could never rest, never stop being vigilant, and even though it wasn't always enough anymore just to keep working, still, there wasn't the luxury of stopping. Faith sat at her desk in her small office late at night, in lamplight, with papers spread out around her. For a long time, Greer had thought that if she ever did get in touch with Faith, she would give her the latest bulletins from her life. She'd write and say, "Get this, Faith. I ended up marrying my high school boyfriend, who I once cried over in your office. At first, I was hesitant to get married. I wasn't sure how I felt about it, but we knew we wanted to have children, so it made sense financially. I knew I loved him, but I don't feel that all love relationships have to culminate in marriage. I was ambivalent at first, but then I came around. We had a wedding on a hill, right near where we both grew up. At the reception, my mother put on a clown show for the kids in attendance. My father stood squinting out over the valley, and he seemed really happy for me. But maybe it was only because he had a mild buzz. Also, my friend Z got married to her longtime partner. We joked about how she was far less ambivalent about getting married than I was. She was raring to get married. It made her so happy. Not just that she and Noelle could do it, that it was legal and common and that progress had been made in this huge way, but mostly that they were doing it. She loved being involved with every aspect of planning the wedding, the shower, the seating arrangements, the song that would be played for the first dance. She just loved it. Her parents, both judges, presided. Everyone cried. And Corey and I have a daughter, Amelia, named after Corey's grandmother. My labor was 23 hours long, and she emerged looking entirely like Corey, as though I had had nothing to do with it. Only now, later on, am I starting to be carved into the stone. The main thing about me is that I'm tired a lot. But I'm tired in part because my book has had me doing nonstop promotion. The day I sold it, the day I got the call, was so exciting. Sometimes I think about how excited you'd get when something big happened to someone else, how you always said it was good for everyone to see more women doing what they loved. I think you would be excited for me. I've decided you are. But I know you have other things to think about, other people who want your time, which I know you probably have to dole out really, really carefully, preserving yourself. Self-preservation is as important as generosity. I talk about this a little in my book. Because if you don't preserve yourself, keep enough for yourself, then of course you have nothing to give. Did you see that you're mentioned first in the acknowledgments? I wondered if you would see it and maybe call me or send me a note and say, "Nailed it." It's true that without you, I would never have written it, and I hope you know that, despite what happened between us. Sometimes I think that maybe you regret what you said to me at the end, in your office. I choose to think you regret it, a little. But lately, Greer had been wishing she could say something different to Faith. "You made my head crack open in college," she'd tell her. "Then, for years, I watched you take whatever you had, your strength, your opinions, your generosity, your influence, and of course your indignation at injustice, all of that, and pour it into other people, usually into women. You never then said to those women, 'Okay, so what you need to do now is pass it on.' But that was what often happened. The big, long story of women pouring what they had into one another. A reflex, maybe, or sometimes an obligation, but always a necessity." At the end of the letter, Greer would say, "When I was in your office that last time, and you were so upset with me and called me out on my behavior, even in that bad moment, there was a kind of effect. You made it necessary for me to go and apologize to my best friend, to tell her the truth. I don't know why I didn't see that that was what I had to do. I mean, for years I didn't see it." But as Greer sat and imagined telling Faith all of this, she still didn't know if she ever would. It might be too much information. It might be unwelcome. It might be that she and Faith had always been on a long, leisurely path toward collapse, and finally it had happened. The moment that the older one first encourages the younger one, maybe the older one already knows it might eventually happen. She knows, while the younger one stays unaware and only excited. One person replaces another, Greer thought. That's what happens. That's what we do, over and over. "Who is going to replace me?" she thought, shocked at first at the idea, and then finding it kind of funny and relaxing into it. She saw various women wandering through her house, populating the place like law enforcement with a search warrant, making themselves at home, overturning anything they wanted. She homed in on an older Kay Chung, rifling through Greer's belongings. Kay wandered around, curious, excited, flipping through the different books on the shelves, finding ones that Greer hadn't lent her but which looked good, then eating from Greer's stash of cashews, swiping a couple of Greer's multivitamins from the big amber bottle on the kitchen counter, as if they might give her the energy, power, and stature that she would need going forward. Kay went into the den and looked at the soft easy chair there, the reading lamp angled beside it. "Sit in the chair, Kay," Greer thought. "Lean back and close your eyes. Imagine being me. It's not so great, but imagine it anyway." At Losai, they had all talked loftily about power, creating summits around it, as though it was a quantifiable thing that would last forever. But it wouldn't. And you didn't know that when you were just starting out. Greer thought of Corey sitting in his brother's bedroom, far from anything having to do with power, taking Slowey out of his box and placing him nearby on the blue carpet. Slowey blinking, moving an arm, craning his head forward. Power eventually slid away, Greer thought. People did what they could, as powerfully as they could, until they couldn't do it anymore. There wasn't much time. In the end, she thought, the turtle might outlive them all.
This is Rebecca Lohman. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Female Persuasion by Meg Wolitzer. This program was directed by Arthur G. Insana. Executive producer, Orly Moskowitz. Text copyright 2018 by Meg Wolitzer. Production copyright 2018 Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.